Good morning, everyone. I'm going to call the meeting to order for today. Just to kind of lay out the plan for this morning's hearing and welcome everyone to the hearing. What we're going to do is have the presentation of the bill and then get testimony from both pro and con with respect to the bill, probably 20 minutes, 25 minutes for each side. So plan in terms of if you're testifying pro or against, that you work with your team to lay it out for 20, 25 minutes. And that'll leave about a half hour for the committee to ask questions and talk about the bill and go over the issues that they think are important. And then we'll plan on taking a vote on the bill sometime a little bit before quarter to nine. So that's kind of the lay of the land with respect to this meeting this morning. We do have a quorum. Representative Fisher, will you move the minutes?
I'm happy to move the minutes, Chair.
Representative Fisher moves the minutes from February 20th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. Representative Atkins. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
And I'm going to go ahead and move your bill to be recommended to pass and be re-referred to government operations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there is an author's amendment. Just put the bill in the shape that I'd like to proceed with it. If the chair would be kind enough to move that as well.
And I will move the author's amendment, the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying
roll
aye.
Call. Chairman, I'd like that roll call when we get done.
Roll call on this amendment. Roll call on the amendment being called. Any discussion before we do the roll call? Hearing none, we'll take the roll.
Johnson.
Aye.
Benson.
No.
Fisher?
Aye.
Hoppy? Kiefer?
No.
Lane? Mason? Metza?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
O'Neill? Savick?
Aye.
Simonson?
Aye.
Sundin?
Aye.
Uglum?
Nope.
The vote is 7-5. The amendment prevails and is approved. Representative Atkins, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And actually, might I ask, just by a show of hands, who's a nurse in the room? Who's a? I was just good. Now that's good. Nurse to patient ratios, Mr. Chairman. I don't know that I've ever felt quite so well protected in a particular room. I may sprain an ankle on purpose as I walk out just to see what kind of care I get. But I appreciate everybody's coming this morning. I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, you're hearing this bill. This bill has a bit of history to it. Literally, it's been offered for about the last decade and has never so much as received a hearing where action was being taken. So I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your willingness to do that and members, your willingness to hear this bill. I would like to say that the reason the bill is being heard is because it's got a better chief author this year, but I think we all know that's not true. Representative Murphy has carried the bill in the past. The reason why I think the bill has a little bit better shot this year is because there's been a significant change that's been made, and that is rather than a hard and fast arbitrary type number that would set a quota or a particular number for ratios, what we are looking at this time around, and I give the Minnesota Nurses Association a lot of credit for taking this step as we start this conversation, is that it would be in, based on nationally accepted evidence-based input. And those standards, again, when we talk about nationally accepted evidence-based, we're not talking about just enforcing or impressing or imposing a number on anybody as much as it is that we're actually talking about looking at real evidence to have that guide the decision. And as we, that's the first part of the bill to the extent that those standards do not exist. We'd look to a committee of professionals to get together and set what those, and again, using evidence and using their professional judgment, what sort of staffing levels we ought to have. Now, it's not a foreign concept to talk about staffing ratios. We've got them in our schools. I was a school board member a long time ago. We talked about what is what's an appropriate level of teacher-to-student ratio or student-to-teacher ratio. We talk about it in daycare centers because we talk about it with vulnerable populations. And, in fact, we talked about it yesterday. I think it was hospital day or something yesterday, and I had any number of folks from hospitals come in and talk to me about the bill. And in fairness, I think most of them were opposed to the bill. But just about all of them talked about how they were using some sort of standards, some sort of best practices to guide them in their staffing decision, staffing level decision making. And that is what the sort of conversation that I'm hoping to invite here. And I think the proponents and opponents would agree on one thing, and that is that we want to protect patients, and we want to make sure that we have those levels of staffing that make the most sense depending on the situation. And if there is a way to guide that and make sure that that happens, I think that's what the aim is here. I will also credit both sides. This is, as anybody who's followed it for the last decade knows, kind of a controversial topic. It gets people's emotions kind of up a little bit, but a credit to both sides. They have approached it in very much a professional way, as we would expect from nurses and hospital administrators, as a conversation, a discussion aimed at trying our best to make sure that we protect and do the best that we can to serve the patients that everybody is seeking to serve. With that, Mr. Chairman, those are my opening comments. I know that there's considerable testimony on both sides, and I'd love to give them more of an opportunity to be heard than me. So I'll turn it back to you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, if you could, unless you have a burning question, hold your questions till we complete testimony in case your answer comes with the testimony. That would be great. I think the people are going to hang around during the time that we're meeting here. So let's begin with Linda Hamilton. Naomi Freiholtz, Joe Howard, they're the three up for the pro side. So however you want to present your information, you're welcome to do so. And first
Thank
and foremost,
you.
Welcome. And I ask that you identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity. My name is Linda Hamilton. I'm a registered nurse. I represent 20,000 registered nurses of the Minnesota Nurses Association, and I've been a registered nurse for 31 years. Currently, I work as a bedside nurse in the newborn intensive care unit at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minneapolis. In hospitals across the state, the situation is dire. Patients are at risk because not enough nurses are on duty, not just on weekends, not just on the night shift, not just when there's an emergency. This has become a standard of practice. It's became routine for my colleagues and I to go to work knowing that we are going to be short-staffed on that shift. Sometimes we get to work, we're two nurses short. Sometimes we're five, but nearly always we are short. Sometimes is now became all the time. My colleagues and I are faced with circumstances of ignoring someone in order to help somebody else. Someone doesn't get medication on time or suffers with pain longer. Someone else hits a call light because they need to get out of bed and can't. Eventually, they do get out of bed. Unfortunately, they end up on the floor. In my case, another someone is a child. A child who has a lot of needs that is being discharged. Parents need to know how to take care of that child. That is the kind of care that comes last on that list of things to do. And it is certainly important. I see patients that are sicker and sicker who need more medications. There's new equipment almost every few months and new therapies. All this care is wonderful and it does save lives. And I am proud to be a part of that moment in a child's life. But many times, that same equipment therapy requires more of my time. I am having to cut out important things in my assessments, observations, and really important, the time it takes to comfort and to alleviate pain. Many times it doesn't take medication. Many times it takes, you'll be okay. Those are the things I miss. And that is important to that child. This doesn't only end in frustration and in further suffering. It ends in a failure to rescue. Preventable events that can cause serious disability and at times can end a life. The facts bear out these events. The latest Minnesota Department of Health 2012 report on adverse events reports the number of deaths have more than doubled since 2011, all of them preventable. The number of serious injuries went up. Bed sores that have been the result of tubes. In times past, nurses would have time to move those tubes, to retape them, to look at the skin, to provide that care. Now, when faced with, I need to give this medication, I need to take care of an important piece of equipment that isn't functioning perhaps correctly, or something needs to be moved on another patient, preventing a patient from pulling out tubes. These are pediatric patients. They do that. That takes time. And it keeps me from doing that, those things that are routine for nurses, but are very important to patients. And you know what's really sad is I can't tell the next shift, I didn't get to this. Can you? Because I know they're going to be just as overwhelmed. The Department of Health report, thorough as it may be, isn't the whole picture. It's just the tip of the iceberg. Nurses across the state send us reports of unsafe staffing situations where, if they hadn't gone the extra mile, a tragedy truly would have happened. And I believe we have summaries of those reports that are available to you. I encourage you to read them and open your heart to these patients. Minnesota nurses also report events to their supervisors, not just when emergencies arrive, but when they realize that whoever scheduled, does the scheduling, has left holes 3 weeks in advance. We know we do not have enough staff to take care of the patients, and we arrive at that for that shift, and we still don't have enough nurses. It's a problem. We've been calling attention to the situation for years, but in return, we're told, well, you're going to have to make do. It'll be okay. We'll get through this. You tell that to that patient who needed to go to the restroom and finally, after having the light on so long, gets up and breaks their hip. I don't think it was okay for them. And I don't think it's okay for our newly graduated nurses who are being put in a situation where they don't have experienced nurses to help them learn the trade like I did when I was starting. It's a crisis, and it's a crisis that is real. Nurses' judgment is being dismissed, and we are the closest professional to that patient. I've been asked, if this is set numbers, this is a ratio, that's what you want. No, we really did a lot of looking in many of cases, looking at different laws across many states. And what we decided is, you know something Minnesota can do better than any of them that are out there. And instead, We have decided that it is better for the patient if we look at what professional standards established by specialty groups have already researched. They are saying these are organizations that are not unions. These are organizations that they're only, the only thing they do is research and such on a certain specialty. In my area, I work in the newborn ICU, it's the Critical Care Nurses Association, CCRN. That organization has looked at patients. They only look at the patients that I care for, and said, a patient with this set of problems needs this much nursing care. And it's different. Some patients, certainly, we don't need to have only one nurse, maybe not even two. But you know something? They all deserve the care that they need, and that's what this bill does, and that is important to this bill. Some areas of nursing are so diverse that there really isn't a specialty organization that we could find that had that research. And in those cases, we've set up a group that will look at those facilities, because the MedSurg patient in Baudette, Minnesota, Abbott Northwestern, Rochester may look very different across those different places. So there won't be a one-size-fits-all straight ratio. Each patient we will be able to say, and look at that facility, yeah, it's going to take this many nurses to take care of this many patients with these issues. That's an important change that we have made, and I believe it is absolutely critical to our success in Minnesota. You're going to hear many arguments about why following the standards of care for patients today is bad policy. Hospitals will say the problem should be handled by professionals, not lawmakers. But with the passage of the Standards of Care Act, it will be decided by professionals. Nurses are professionals. We will establish standards, and we will have those standards upheld. Hospitals may say it's a problem that can be solved through contracts, but taking off my union hat for a moment, I'll tell you, Minnesotans deserve more than that. Patient care shouldn't depend on negotiations. We have hospitals that are non-contract. How do they protect their patients? This law will protect patients across the entire state. A patient will have a standard. Not nurses. It's not my decision. It's researched, and we will figure that out, what that number should be. Because our patients don't deserve a two-tiered system where you have a boutique hospital, the standards are there. But, you know, in the hospital across the town, perhaps it's a bargain hospital, and their care is substandard. That's not Minnesota. The hospitals will tell you it's too expensive. Employees, even nurses, will have to be laid off. But a report by the California nurses, 4 years after the state instituted a similar policy, shows that more nurses meant less overtime and less cost to the hospitals. The cost did not go up. But the fact is, the California bill we did not feel was a solution. Standards of Care Act uses the best of all ideas with nationally accepted standards of patient care, and ensures Minnesota hospitals are held accountable to them. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Standards for a hospital in Marshall will be different than those in a metropolitan hospital or even Montevideo or another small hospital. From the Twin Cities to Detroit Lakes, every hospital needs to be accountable for providing an environment that ensures nurses can deliver bedside care safely. I thank you for listening to this bill, and I thank you for the time.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Hamilton. And is it Naomi?
Naomi, yes.
Naomi, if you'd identify yourself for the record and give your testimony. Before you begin, is there Joe Howard here? Okay, so we want to make sure we have time for Mr. Howard to on your side as well. You have about 10-12 minutes to work with.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, good morning. My name is Naomi Freiholtz. I'm a registered nurse, and I've been a registered nurse for more than 5 years. including 3 of the years at the Sleepy Eye Medical Center. I'm happy to tell you I was recently awarded Employee of the Year at my hospital as well. At Sleepy Eye, we are a recently organized bargaining unit of nurses under the Minnesota Nurses Association. We've been trying to organize for one reason and one reason only, and that's patient safety. That's our number one concern, and we have risked reprisal and retaliation to speak up for our patients for any sort of solution that would give them standards of care. We've lost 33 nurses in 3 years at our hospital. 2 retired early and 31 have just outright quit. We stand to lose 6 more if things don't change. And if you ask me why, it's because of unsafe staffing. I wish everyone could see how frequently the nursing staff is pulled into situations that are unsafe. It happens on a daily basis. Every day we are concerned about the safety of the patients we care for and the means of our livelihood. As licensed professionals under the Minnesota Nurse Practice Act and the Nurses Code of Ethics, we are held accountable for maintaining the safety of our patients. If we make a mistake or if we accept a patient assignment beyond our abilities, we are at risk of discipline through the Board of Nursing and or our employer, or even with the possibility of malpractice case in a court of law. In addition, we have to live with the moral distress that we may have overextended ourselves past the point where we can safely care for our patients. Understaffing occurs on all of our shifts. For example, during the night shifts, which I work on a regular basis, as one of only 3 fully trained nurses in different units, I'm asked to be backup in the OR as well. On the weekends, we have no backup nurse for me when I'm called away from the floor to work in the OR. When I'm in the OR, I'm the on-call nurse and the working charge nurse at the same time. One example is recently I worked my 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. shift. I had to stay for an emergency surgery. I was there till 1:30 p.m. I went home and slept 3 hours and got called back for another emergency surgery at 5 o'clock. And I was there till 1 in the morning, and I was expected to stay and work my shift till 7 a.m. I asked the charge nurse that also had to work 18 and a half hours because I was in the OR to call the assistant DON in to work for me because I could no longer physically or mentally care for my patients safely. After informing, although she is not trained to be in the operating room, if a necessary surgery would have been needed after that, the patient could have been at risk due to the inexperience of the nurse who was forced to work in a situation where she was out of her element due to the chronic understaffing issues. Shifts like this are all too common. They're the norm, not the extreme. This is when mistakes happen. This is when the patients don't get the medication at the appropriate time, or they get the wrong medication because there are not enough nurses to monitor the timing of the medication. We have had patients left in the ER for as long as 8 hours waiting for a bed because we don't have the staff to admit them. This only delays the care of those patients. I'm happy to report my hospital has hired 2 more nurses in the last 2 months, but it doesn't begin to close the gap. From what I've seen, the lack of orientation for these nurses will continue to be a danger to patients. How would you like to be lying in intensive care knowing that the nurse at your bedside is actually experienced as a geriatric or an obstetric nurse, or the nurse who's performing your daughter's blood transfusion has never done it before? The motto of Sleepy Eye Medical Center is people you know caring for people you love. Unfortunately, it is getting increasingly more difficult to provide safe care for friends, families, and neighbors when our hospital does not abide by safe standards of care in staffing. Please help assure the patients at my hospital and across the state that there will be adequate staffing in their hospitals by voting yes on the Standards of Care, on the Standards of Care Act. If you ask me what brought me here today, it is my patients. Let's keep our great reputation in Minnesota and maintain the healthcare standards. We should be a role model to all the other states and a healthcare leader, and leaders set the standard. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you so much for your testimony. If you could stick around in case legislators have any questions for you, that'd be great. And Mr. Howard? And is there anybody else on the pro side who wanted to speak? Just so make sure they get a chance. I don't see anybody. Okay, Mr. Howard, you want to go ahead with your testimony? You have about 5 minutes.
Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Joe Howard. I've been a registered nurse for 11 years. For the past year and a half, I've had the pleasure of working in the burn intensive care unit at Miller Dwan in Duluth. As a nurse in the burn unit, you can imagine some of the serious cases we've seen. The simple act of changing a dressing is a timely but necessary procedure that cannot be overlooked, but sometimes we have to steal from Peter to pay Paul to get things done. Last Tuesday, I arrived at work, looked at the staffing schedule. I saw that the numbers of nurses on duty appeared to be enough, but no thought was given to the acuity of the patients. It was clear that we were short-staffed. We were also down a nursing assistant. We had dressing changes and insulin checks that needed to get done, but not enough people to do them. We requested a backup nurse from the rehab unit to come in, which robbed that unit of a body. Even with that extra person, routine procedures were missed. I feel personally responsible that I could not give the patients the best care that I should have. It's an awful, awful feeling. You have a patient that's 100% dependent on you for the care, and you cannot provide that care because you do not have enough hands. It's the worst feeling in the world. It's enough to bring a guy like me to tears. This is nothing new. We've been telling management that staffing is an issue. We filled out those unsafe staffing reports. In 2010, we thought we finally addressed the problem. We were able to negotiate contract language that addressed staffing issues, including new hires and time for education for new nurses. But that language has fallen on deaf ears. Part of that agreement was a grid system that would be implemented to determine staffing levels. But in 2.5 years, those grids that say so many nurses should be working for so many patients is not in place. Since then, we continue to have patients who wait in the ER for up to 3 days until beds are open when a nurse can care for them. We continue to have situations where two nurses are taking care of 18 patients, and we continue to ask for more help, but we're told that there are no nurses available to come in. I floated to another unit last week, med-surg unit, where I learned that two nurses were in charge of 18 patients on the night shift, but nobody on the incoming day shift was even asked to come in early to relieve and help. If you've ever been burned yourself on a hot stove, maybe you can imagine the pain a burn victim goes through with a second or third degree burn. Once the skin grafting has taken place, the pain only continues. So imagine the effects of understaffing to a burn victim when there aren't enough nurses to properly administer their pain medication on time. Imagine each additional minute they wait wallowing in agony. It's another minute they needlessly suffer. This can't continue. If hospitals won't listen to nurses that we stretch too thin to properly change dressings, then perhaps they'll listen to you. Perhaps they'll honor the standards that national organizations have established to ensure that patients receive the proper care. The standards still allow local hospitals to make staffing decisions. The staffings are different for each unit in each hospital, in each situation, given patient census and patient acuity. All the standards really mandate is that if you come to my Minnesota hospital, you will receive good care. Patients in our state deserve that. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
Before I'm sure you have a very extensive list of testifiers, but before we move on from nurses, could you ask if there are any other nurses from outside of the Minnesota Nursing Association that would like to testify so we can have nurses next to nurses in this testimony?
Well, we'll move. Yeah, I think we have some actually lined up to testify. Yeah, so thank you. Let's move to the those who oppose the bill at this time. And I have, looks like, six people on the list, so we'll just go right down the line here. Mr. Lawrence Massa and Carolyn Wilson. The two of you are going to go together, and Sandra Mae McCarthy, welcome. Welcome to all of you. You have about 20, 25 minutes, something like that, to work with, and however you want to present your information, you're welcome to do so. And we'll also have time, as Representative Benson indicated, if there's somebody who didn't get a chance to testify, we'll certainly get that opportunity. So if you identify yourself for the record and begin with your testimony, that'd be great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Lawrence Massa, and I'm the president and CEO of the Minnesota Hospital Association. We represent 144 hospitals and health systems that deliver quality patient care to patients 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year throughout our state. With me this morning are Carolyn Wilson, President of the University of Minnesota Medical Center, Fairview, Sandra Mack McCarthy, Chief Nursing Officer from Essentia Health System in Duluth, Roger Lloyd, an RN and nurse leader from Essentia, and Mary Pinn, Chief Nursing Officer from Health East here in St. Paul. Before taking this position at the Hospital Association, I was a CEO at Rice Memorial Hospital in Wilmer. I know firsthand that nurses are essential to the well-earned reputation of our state, and I'm convinced that nurses and hospitals share the same goals of delivering safe patient care. However, the legislation before you today isn't about standards of care, it's about government-mandated staffing quotas. I know that in this era of rhetorical embellishments, it's popular to say black is white and white is black, but facts are stubborn. Whatever label M&A puts on this bill, it is a ratio bill, pure and simple, and staffing ratios equal quotas. Let me explain why we feel that way. First, take the M&A's own words at face value. In announcing the legislation at the February 13th news conference, Linda Hamilton, president of the M&A, who you've heard from this morning, said the bill is needed so that hospitals staff to standards of care that have been developed through professional judgment in every hospital, on every shift, in every unit across the state. That's a quota. Second, the bill calls on Minnesota to follow the lead of four professional organizations. The facts are clear. In healthcare, there are dozens of professional organizations. They don't set national standards of care. Their purpose is to represent a host of special interests. Two of the organizations cited in the legislation promote ratios or quotas. The other two propose a different approach to setting standards. In other words, the four organizations are in conflict. No doubt that this is M&A's intention, because the legislation says, in the absence of an evidence-based standard, a politically appointed work group with three-fourths of the slots designated to nurses will make the decision. The only outcome from an M&A work group is quotas. The third issue this committee should be aware of is the impact of this legislation on collective bargaining. M&A represents just 20% of the nurses in the state. Just 64 hospitals out of 148 have M&A contracts. These collective bargaining agreements include provisions for joint work groups within each hospital to cooperatively determine staffing and other work rules. That's what we did at Rice, an M&A hospital, and it happens across the state. M&A is now trying to undermine the collective bargaining process, asking the legislature to impose government-mandated quotas that they haven't been able to get through negotiation. And one reason they haven't succeeded in getting quotas through collective bargaining is because of the devastating impact quotas will have on other hospital caregivers and workers, including members represented by other unions. You obviously have recognized that in the amendment that you adopted earlier this morning that would prevent hospitals from laying off other members of the caregiving staff, which we find problematic given the fact that we are trying to change the care delivery model in the face of health reform, new technology, and many things that affect our operations on a day-to-day basis. Mandatory staffing quotas would increase hospital labor costs, and clearly with the amendment that you've adopted, by a considerable amount. Hospital reimbursement rates are also under pressure from every payer. We're trying to reduce costs to reduce the cost and make care more affordable. The additional cost is unaffordable by hospitals, employers, individuals, and taxpayers who pay the cost of health care. It would have two immediate effects. Healthcare costs would increase, and hospitals would be forced to look to other avenues to reduce expenses, which now has been limited by the amendment that you've adopted. Finally, one bill supporter was quoted at the February 13th press conference as saying, "This legislation puts the decision at the bedside, not at the Capitol." We disagree. The irony is that decisions are already made at the bedside by experienced nursing professionals based on the needs of the patients, based on the capabilities of the nurses available. That's what's expected of nurses and the critical thinking that they bring to the care process. This bill takes the opposite direction. It takes decisions away from local hospitals and nurse leaders who work closely with nurses and other caregivers to determine staffing and turns it over to the government. If Minnesota hospitals had a crisis of quality or safety, we would be having a different discussion. But again, the facts are clear, even though they stand in contrast to what the MNA would have you believe. In 2012, Minnesota ranked first in the nation for quality health care by the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. In addition, multiple independent quality improvement organizations ranked Minnesota the top of the nation for patient safety and quality of care measures. And if you want to discuss standards, then look at the gold standard of patient satisfaction measures, the Hospital Consumer Assessment of Healthcare Providers and Systems Survey, or the HCAP survey that's required of all hospitals participating in Medicare. On every single measure of patient satisfaction across the board, Minnesota hospitals rank higher than California, the only state with government-imposed staffing quotas, and higher than the national average. The simple truth is this: quotas do not equal quality, and what is being proposed is a quota bill. Even though the bill doesn't lay those out, it creates a process for the government to set those quotas. So thank you for the opportunity to testify. I would like to address one comment that was made earlier in the testimony in the adverse events report that was just released. Pressure ulcers actually went down in the reporting period, not up. And the health department will be able to document that less than 1% of the adverse events were attributed to staffing issues based on the root cause analysis that's performed when those things happen. So thank you again for the opportunity.
And thank you very much for your testimony. And if you'd identify yourself for the record,
so,
go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Carolyn Wilson. I am a registered nurse, and I currently serve our community and state as president of the University of Minnesota Medical Center Fairview in Minneapolis. Each day, our academic hospital treats thousands of adults, children, and babies in our hospital rooms, outpatient clinics, emergency departments, and surgical suites. We perform the most complex care available. We also are the state's largest provider of Medicaid services, helping ensure care access to all Minnesotans. Our team is made up of more than 6,600 clinical and support staff, 1,600 physicians, and 300 medical residents collaborating to deliver superior health outcomes. And I'm proud to say we're really good at what we do. Our hospital is consistently ranked number one in the Twin Cities and among the nation's best in 11 specialties by U.S. News and World Report. Minnesota hospitals are among the highest in quality nationally, and I want to see that quality continue and only get better. Minnesotans can take great pride in the consistent quality of hospitals throughout the state. The highly regarded Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality recently ranked Minnesota's health system as the best in the nation, with care in hospitals as one of the major contributors to the high score. We rank among the nation's best in virtually every measure of patient care and safety. The Health Grades Patient Safety and American Hospital Study ranks hospitals in Minneapolis-St. Paul as the best in the nation among metro areas of at least 1 million. So let's start with this reality. When proponents of this legislation say it is needed to improve the quality of care, the facts tell a very different story. Objective studies consistently rank Minnesota hospitals as among the nation's best. The challenges we face today won't be solved by establishing fixed nurse staffing quotas as this bill would require us to do. A new era is well underway in healthcare. Hospitals are being asked to care for populations and to improve quality and patient satisfaction. Meanwhile, individuals, government programs, insurers, and employers are demanding that hospitals and all health providers reduce the overall cost of care. Minnesota's hospitals are approaching this challenge with innovation. They are all in the forefront of creating new models of care delivery. Increasingly, hospitals will be rewarded for keeping patients healthy, keeping them out of the hospital, and if hospital care is needed, assuring that they have the best possible outcomes. The transition to the new health marketplace that we're undergoing requires flexibility and resources to innovate and to meet the challenges of this changing healthcare marketplace. What won't change, though, is the focus of hospitals on delivering safe, quality patient care and ensuring nurses and hospital leaders have the ability and flexibility to continue to deliver exceptional care into the future. As I reviewed the Standards of Care Act, I do not believe it will do anything to improve care in our hospitals. Rather, the act will erode the necessary flexibility by imposing government staffing mandates and would put politicians and government at our patients' bedside. The act is a one-size-fits-all approach that would significantly negatively impact our ability to deliver the right care at the right time to our patients. As a registered nurse and hospital administrator with more than 20 years of experience, I know firsthand how excellence is achieved in a hospital. I ask that you keep healthcare delivery decisions in the hands of healthcare professionals and oppose the Standards of Care Act. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. And Ms. McCarthy?
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Representatives, thank you for hearing our testimony today.
If you'd identify yourself, go ahead.
I am Sandra McCarthy, or as most people know me, I go by Mac. I am the Chief Nursing Officer for Essentia Health. I'm a Dr. McCarthy. Before taking this job, I was the Chief Nursing Officer and Vice President of Patient Care Services for Cape Fear Valley Healthcare System, multiple hospital system in North Carolina. Prior to that, I was the Chief Nursing Officer at the Cleveland Clinic Healthcare System. And before that, I had worked as a Chief Nursing Officer for the Veterans Health Administration in the Pittsburgh-Butler, Pennsylvania area. And before that, I was a Chief Nursing Officer for the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So before anybody thinks that I've been removed from nursing for so long, just a quick note, I have two undergraduate degrees, two master's degree, and a doctorate, and each of them have required clinical orientation. And I graduated with my doctorate last May, and it required a clinical orientation, so I'm well-versed in the clinical setting. My job as the Chief Nursing Officer is broad and covers a variety of responsibilities, but one of the very biggest responsibilities, or should I say two, is that we are patient advocates. And on top of that, the Chief Nursing Officer is the nurse's advocate. Ultimately, I am accountable and responsible for the perfect balance of clinical service, safety, and cost. The most important component of achieving that balance is the caregiving team of professionals. And the one thing, the very basis of the profession of nursing is our critical thinking skills and having the ability to assess patients, evaluate, and implement plans, and be able to move staff accordingly to the needs of the patient and how sick they are, whether that be coming through the emergency department, life flights that fly into the hospital, changing on the medical surgical units or in our surgical units. That very professional critical thinking skills of the nurse allows that flexibility. So registered nurses play a critical role in our hospitals. What distinguishes our very good nurses from our great nurses is that critical thinking, especially being part of the interprofessional team in the healthcare systems in Minnesota. We depend on nurses to make good judgments about the care of patients, but also about the flow of work and being able to move staff as needed. From speaking with my colleagues in Minnesota, I have heard very few instances when nurses need additional staff to a unit based on acuity or numbers that has not been met, that we have been able to move staff. We have float pools in all of our organizations. If there is a change in the patient's condition, we have code blues that can be called, we have rapid responses that can be called, and many of us have SWAT nurses that can go from unit to unit and be able to provide assistance to any of the nurses who may need it. Healthcare is changing, and how it's delivered in the hospital is very different from a decade ago. Today, we develop teams and deliver our care through teams. The first thing, there are four components of teams. One is expertise. Safe staffing depends on expert staffing. Nursing and other professionals must have the training and knowledge to be able to make the right decisions. For every patient and every staffing, we must look at each patient individually. It's not a one-size-fits-all. That's a very, very high bar, but one that nurses and other caregivers in Minnesota hospitals is consistent to meet. The second component of the teamwork is teamwork and being able to be flexible for nurses to work as part of an efficient, effective team, working with physicians, licensed practical nurses, nursing assistants, and being able to assess and make changes as the acuity and illness of the patient is changing. It allows us to respond to emergencies, making sure that nurses are able to deliver patients the care that they need at that moment. Many of the instances where we have to change, we had the big flu season that just happened. We had to flex staffing all over the hospital in all departments to be able to meet the volumes that came into the hospital. Collaboration is the third component of the team today. Minnesota Healthcare earns top ratings for its patient outcomes based on its tradition of collaboration among the healthcare community, By tracking outcomes and sharing best practices, hospitals determine what systems and procedures are most effective that save time and money. Technology is the fourth component of the team. Patients benefit the most when a nurse has the time to interact directly with everyone in his or her care. Many of our hospitals today, if not most, have been working with our nurses at the bedside to determine what staffing plans should look like. We are listening, and we are improving that on a day-to-day basis. One of the things that I wanted to say about the act being called the standard of care is this is very important, and I hope that you will listen carefully to this. The standards of care is an inappropriate name for the act. There is an already existing standard of care set forth by our professional organization, the American Nurses Association, that addresses more than staffing. It means our professional practice standards, the very core of our profession. This proposed bill undermines that practice by a core function of assessing patient needs and adjusting accordingly on a daily and even an hourly basis. Nursing is a recognized profession with a scope and standard clearly stated by the American Nurses Association. Any proposed bill that includes the word standard is unnecessary and shifts control of existing standards established and determined by nursing to others who do not understand the complexity of nurses and the care of services that we provide. I would just like to end by saying that this is your opportunity to understand what is before you. Many of my colleagues across the country are asking, why Minnesota? Minnesota has great quality outcomes. It is not difficult to recruit nurses to this state. They are pathing it very similar to what happened in California. And I know you're all well educated on what happened there. Poor quality outcomes after mandatory staffing ratios, layoffs, hospital closure, and after the first year of nurses tracking to the state for higher wages just to get the ratios up, 1 year later, they left the state. So the state has not improved at all. Minnesota, great outcomes. We have great nursing. We have great access. The only thing that I have replied in saying why they're considering it is that our legislators have really been misinformed. Thank you for giving us this opportunity yesterday and today to educate you and inform you. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you for your testimony, and have a little less than 10 minutes left. Ms. Pinn and Mr. Lloyd, go ahead with your testimony and identify yourself.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Roger Lloyd. I am a nurse and have been one for about 26 years. I work at Essentia Health in Duluth. I'm a nursing manager on one of our med-surg floors. I think what got me this spot on this today is that I have personal experience and was in California. I went there in 1995. I'm a native Minnesotan. But I spent 11 years in California, and I was there when the racial laws came into effect, and was there and had to deal with those laws, and saw that the outcomes weren't anywhere near what they were hoping and expecting. What I believe happened is the nursing were not prepared for the outcome of it. They ended up having to do cares and things because of the remix of ratios and remix of staffing components that frankly RNs hadn't done in many years. They were doing cares that nursing assistants and others had to do, and it was unfortunate. They imposed that in 2004. I left and came back home in 2006. Most of my background in California was in the emergency setting, which truly was less affected by the med surge and the inpatient. And then California also had a Title 22 law, which mandated already that the ICU ratio was 2-1. I think that's pretty much what we live by here as well. I don't know if there's such a law as well. But overall, having lived in that system and worked in California, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind that this state is far and away better and does a better job in healthcare. I mean, the numbers are there. But I don't think there's any dispute with that. Let me say first, are the patient. This is what why nursing gets and those in healthcare do what they do. We're in it for the patient. That is what brings caregivers into our profession. An opportunity to work closely with people at times when they are vulnerable, to provide them comfort and to help them on their healing journey is why I and other nurses became nurses. It is why scores and surveys that are done objectively and unbiased third parties consistently rank satisfaction of nurses at the top of the scale. Here are facts. Based on the data compiled and analyzed by the highly regarded Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, Minnesota has the nation's best healthcare system. A key factor is the quality of the state's hospitals. Consistently, the AHRQ ranks Minnesota above average on patient safety and patient-centered measures. California consistently ranks below that average, and I know because it was a constant battle to try and get us up within the normal range. I can tell you from personal experience of having worked in both states, the data play out on a day-to-day experience, and the quality of healthcare in Minnesota hospitals is far superior. The second issue to consider is the impact of government-imposed staffing quotas on my colleagues. The California law has forced good and needed hospitals to close. I was involved in one of those, and has sent costs skyrocketing because the law forced hospitals to lay off LPNs so they could hire more RNs. That didn't produce better health care. It resulted in a higher paid RNs for doing work that the LPNs and others had been doing. The erosion of the professionalism of RNs is a key reason why the American Nurses Association has not endorsed staffing quotas, arguing instead of greater flexibility. This plays out in real life in ways that directly affect patients and colleagues. At Ascension, especially in some of our small rural hospitals, we have felt the impact of this season's flu epidemic, like Mac was talking about. In a world of ratios, what my experience was, when you've met the quota, the floor or the has received X amount of patients, you cannot flex them. What happens then is you have to start going on divert, having to start closing your emergency rooms, patients backing up because the floors cannot have any ability to flex and maybe take another patient or two. It's a true problem. I know in one of our sister hospitals in Nevada, ambulances were known to drive around hospitals for hours waiting for some place to open up. So here's what happens in today's world. Besides, nurses are asked to use their critical judgment to determine which patients might be ready to go home. They are asked to evaluate the care teams. Nurse managers work side by side with other caregivers. The bottom line, flu victims receive the care they need in their local hospital. We collaborate, we shift caregivers to where patients most need them, and we make sure everything is done at the highest level of quality. Under the rigid quotas that would become the outcome of this legislation, a very different scenario plays out. Flexibility is lost. Nurses can't be moved to where they are needed because quotas will not allow it. In a small hospital, flu victims and other emergency room patients are sent to hospitals miles away. Not because they don't have staff, but because we don't have the flexibility to use our critical thinking skills and are essentially to help our quality health care.
Mr. Lloyd? Right here. Excellent testimony. I want to make sure Ms. Penn gets a chance to talk to, and we're kind of running low on
one line left. This isn't speculation. It's reality. It's what happened in California. I lived it as a Minnesotan. I do not want to live it again. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for your testimony. And Ms. Penn, if you want to identify yourself and just take a couple minutes, maybe not go over what's already been said, but what do you think is the most important points for us to
Thank you, Mr. Chair, fellow committee members. My name is Mary Penn. I'm the Vice President, Chief Nursing Quality Officer for the Healthy Care System here in St. Paul. As we discuss the proposed legislation, it's important to keep in mind there's unanimous agreement about the key point that registered nurses are critical to the service we provide. The nurses in Minnesota hospitals are highly regarded for their professionalism. In turn, job satisfaction among nurses rank very high. Health East nurses, for example, report high levels of satisfaction as employees. This fall, for the seventh time, our employees voted us the best place to work in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Business Journal. Many of the other hospitals in the state can cite similar engagement scores too. Our commitment to attracting and retaining the best nurses in the country is not just empty rhetoric. Hospitals increasingly rely on care delivery models based on shared decision making. Nurses are central to enhancing quality and implementing best practices in our care delivery. In order to attract and retain the best, we understand that we must offer nationally competitive compensation packages. I have been directly involved for many years in negotiating contracts between MNA nurses and the six largest Twin City hospital systems, including HealthEast. As you may know, this past fall, the Twin City Hospitals proposed a streamlined process to negotiate and settle a new three-year contract with MNA. We felt it was important during this time of significant change in healthcare that our entire team be focused on our nation-leading quality care while improving patient satisfaction and reducing the overall cost of care. We were pleased the MNA accepted our offer of early negotiations, and collaboratively we were able to reach a fair agreement on a new contract nearly 6 months before the existing contract expired. The contract will continue to make MNA nurses in the Twin City Hospitals among the best compensated in the country. Today, before the new contract goes into effect, the average hourly rate of an MNA nurse working in the Twin City Hospital is more than $44. That annualizes to a salary of $91,693. And to put that in perspective, according to comparable data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the average hourly rate for RNs nationally is $29.03, or annualized $60,390, about two-thirds of the MNA rate in Twin City Hospitals.
And Mrs. Pinn, if you could wind it up quickly here, because we have one other testifier, and I want to make sure legislators have a chance to ask questions.
Very good. In closing, just we want to point out that it is very important that we feel RNs need to work to the top of their license, the right person giving the right care to the patients we serve. We worry that this bill will compromise that ability of RNs to work to the top of the license, and that also in our contractual agreements, we do have monthly committee meetings where we do discuss and take action on staffing, and lastly, that it does take all team members to care and give that high quality, and would urge you that this not to impose this legislation of one union's agenda on all of the workforce in our hospitals in the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much for your testimony. Lastly, Kate Johansson, I see you on the list here. And if you could be very succinct in your comments so we can open it up to questions and issues from our colleagues here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Kate Johansson. I represent the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce and its 2,400 employer members, 80% of which are small employers. The Minnesota Chamber opposes this legislation for a few simple but strong reasons. First, it increases the cost of care. Second, it doesn't improve the quality of care. And third, it is poor public policy. With respect to the first concern, the Minnesota Chamber has long supported policies that maintain access, especially for small businesses, to care by keeping it affordable. Unfortunately, this legislation increases costs. Our members consistently rank the cost of health care as one of their main obstacles, one of their top three obstacles to growing jobs and growing their business. But the only result of this legislation is a government-mandated staffing ratio quota, and the only outcome of such a quota is an increase in health care costs. As other testifiers have noted, we've seen this effect well documented in California, and the Chamber would simply ask you please not to add another costly mandate to health care at a time when small business is already struggling to maintain coverage and when the administration has made streamlining government oversight of providers and bending the health care cost curve a priority. Now, certainly, cost is not the only factor, and that leads me to my second point, which, as another testifier aptly pointed out, is quality. Quality does not necessarily generate from quotas, or quotas don't mean quality. The Minnesota Chamber usually tries to pursue health care policies that achieve the triple aim, one of the primary goals of which is to improve health outcomes overall. One of the best ways to improve health outcomes is to pay for outcomes instead of services. This legislation does not accomplish that goal. We should be focusing on quality. A mandate might provide illusory comfort, but it does not indeed promote results, and that is our goal here. California, again, is a perfect example of this legislation increasing costs but not the quality of care. We want to align our policies with the direction articulated by the administration, that of the triple aim, and doing what's good for system reform overall and patients. And that also leads me to my third reason for opposing the bill, which is simply that it's poor public policy. The Minnesota Chamber strongly believes that maintaining flexibility for local care providers to make the best decisions for their patients is the best policy for Minnesota. There has been some discussion of using an evidence-based model, but who knows better the evidence of their communities than local providers themselves? They are in the best position and have the strongest interest to provide good quality care, and they've demonstrated a commitment to that goal through their current efforts to innovate and provide new, more effective quality care delivery mechanisms. At the end of the day, we all share the goal of having healthy patients, and our care providers and nurses do a great job of achieving that objective. But the Chamber is concerned that this legislation will increase cost and thus prevent access for many small businesses in particular, not lead to better quality outcomes, and strip local providers of the flexibility they need to continue innovation to deliver real reforms. And for those reasons, we respectfully oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Johansson. And we're going to move on to questions and issues relative to this legislation. It looks like Representative Atkins is going to take a front seat again. And first on the list is Representative O'Driscoll. And I know we have the people who testified are still around, and I'm sure they can come up and answer questions. And even before we get to that, is there anyone who wanted to speak to the bill that didn't get a chance in the audience? Okay, very good, Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to compliment you on the way that we've heard testimony today. We gave folks their time to be able to visit pro or con on this, and I appreciate you keeping people to those timelines. I think that's important as well. A couple of questions on this that have occurred to me on the testimony, and I guess maybe I'll refer to Representative Adkins or others. And first of all, is there anyone from the Department of Health here today? I know that they are the ones who license hospitals, and it really goes to the concerns that were raised about staffing levels. And my understanding is that there's a mechanism in place that those kinds of grievances or issues can be brought to the Department of Health's attention. I'm just wondering if there's anyone here today from the Department of Health who could address those, if they've received complaints or what the process is.
I see someone moving behind you, but I'm not sure if they're running away or coming down. So. Like they're coming. Okay. Morning. Welcome. And if you would identify yourself and take a shot at Representative O'Driscoll's question, please.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Diane Rydrick. I'm the director of the Division of Health Policy for the Minnesota Department of Health. And I didn't know running away was an option. I exercised that. But could you repeat what the question was, please?
Representative O'Driscoll?
Oh, Mr. Chair, thank you. We had heard that there were questions about staffing levels and that those weren't be able to be worked out between employer and employee. My understanding is that there's a mechanism that's in place where they can appeal to the Department of Health to raise those questions and those issues because of public safety and the Department of Health being the licensing entity for the hospitals. I'm just wondering if you could give us some background as to nature and complaints that you receive and how those may be being currently resolved.
Mm-hmm. Ms. Roderick?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, so I represent the Division of Health Policy, which is not the licensing division of the department. What I could speak to is a report that was referenced a little earlier on adverse health events and patient safety, which is a report that we do out of my division. A few years ago, the legislature directed the health department to put together a work group to look at nurse staffing issues. And we did so, and through that process, we came up with a set of questions that we expect hospitals to ask whenever certain reportable adverse health events happen. So in those cases, we expect there to be questions that are asked as part of what's called a root cause analysis so that we know whether staffing was an issue related to that particular event. So that's one mechanism where we do find out about staffing. In general, we very rarely hear about staffing coming up as an issue in that set of reportable events. Maybe once a year it comes up as a root cause for those adverse events. In terms of licensing and whether there are mechanisms for nurses to raise state safe staffing issues through the licensure process, or for us to address that through that process. I can check with the folks who do the hospital licensing, which is in our compliance monitoring division, and see if there's a mechanism there. I know that we do have a process for anybody to file a complaint about a facility, and they can do investigations when authorized related to Medicare conditions of participation, abuse, neglect, and other issues. What I don't know is whether they have a specific mechanism that's specific to staffing outside of that process, but we can find that and get back to you.
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the testimony because I think that that's an important component that we already have a mechanism that's in place to deal with these and looking at how that's working. Another question I guess I have for the author of the bill, Representative Atkins, does this bill in any way compromise, sidestep PELRA?
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, there's no desire to do so.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
O'Driscoll?
And the reason I ask that is lines 313, well actually 311 through probably the 335 talks about establishing the Patient Safety Assignment Committee, and it talks about members of the workforce, 60% of which would be registered nurses, and then the other 40% spelled out how that would be. And from my read on this, they would have the ability then to usurp management's decisions and make staffing decisions. And under PELRA, that's rights of management to make staffing decisions, and this would sidestep PELRA. I know that's an important consideration for both management and labor under PELRA, and so I just was wondering if there was any issues that you could bring forward for us and some assurances that this would not diminish labor and or management's rights under PELRA.
Representative Atkins?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Driscoll, that's not the intention, and we'll make sure that we ensure that the language doesn't do that.
Very good. Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Atkins, I'm struggling here. I see the bill is, after testimony, Minnesota's number one in patient care, highest quality, lowest cost of health in the nation. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, it's a bill that's a solution in search of a problem. I really don't see how this is going to help. I along the same lines, one of the reasons I called for a roll call on the amendment, it's a bad bill, and I think the amendment even made it worse. And my concern is that it is a violation of collective bargaining. And we're ready to put into statute that an industry cannot lay off. I don't know of any place else in statute where we mandate that. And my worry is we've started down a road, and this is the first time we're going to do it. We're going to put it in statute, folks, that an industry cannot look at its costs and make adjustments based on what's needed in order to operate. And I'm not looking at motives of the author, but simply to say that this is a result of looking at what happened in California. And when California did this, what happened was, because of the new staffing ratios, they had to lay off hundreds, if not thousands, of LPNs and nursing assistants in order to make those quotas. And trained RPNs, RNs, had to then do the work that was being done by somebody with less training, less pay. There was literally scores of hospitals that needed to shut down. I'm using maybe some hyperbole. I don't have the exact number in front of me, but same kind of hyperbole I think was we heard in previous testimony. 12. But you know that certainly couldn't have helped healthcare in the communities where those hospitals were shut down because of this action. And then. The Minnesota Nursing Association represents only 20% of the nurses in the state. Their national American Nursing Association doesn't support it. But we're traveling down this road because we think this is going to improve. My concern, and the reason I asked for the roll call, Representative Atkins, is help me understand how the amendment that you added in order to cover up the fact that we're probably going to need to lay people off, but we won't be able to do this, how that's going to impact that industry in terms of helping with costs, medical costs being as high as they are.
Representative Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Representative Benson. And I actually don't mind having my motives questioned. I've never really troubled me. My one motive here is patient safety. And I am really appreciative of the fact that you asked the question that you did and made the statement that you did. Because one thing that came clear to me, and I wrote it down because I said the one thing that the opponents of this legislation did not take issue or even question was the existence of ongoing situations that were described by the first three testifiers that, quite frankly, are downright scary and clearly threaten patient safety. My takeaway from this hearing, and I'm glad that we're having it, is that there is a striking, even scary, staffing disparity, clearly between, in the fact that it wasn't even questioned, between what is happening in certain hospitals and apparently what's happening in other hospitals. And as a Minnesotan or any Minnesotan, that's a little scary. I had no idea it was so, that there was such a gulf in terms of what was happening in certain places. And the fact that the testimony of the first three folks, that there was not even a question raised about the veracity, nor would I expect. I mean, these are all professionals that we're talking about. But clearly, there is a demand for something that sets the bar. And the language of the bill is fairly simple in that respect. Just says, as a condition of licensure, hospitals must at all times provide enough qualified registered nursing personnel on duty to provide the standard of care necessary for the well-being of patients. I am shocked that there could be any question of that, and then equally shocked that that we would be wanting to, and for those who oppose the amendment, that we would want to further threaten the well-being of patients by potentially laying off LPNs or other folks. So I don't believe that that is an issue. In fact, I believe that, and I think it would be borne out, that if you were to lay off those folks to try to save a few dollars on one end, you'd end up costing yourself a fortune on the other, because a lot of those folks that you lay off, the LPNs or others, or don't have adequate RNs, you end up sending people home before they're ready. You end up giving them treatment that they that doesn't fit their needs, and the cost of doing so and readmitting folks that went home too early or whatever the situation may be is dramatically more expensive. So I actually think we probably, in the long run, and I think the studies bear this out across the country, we actually save money by having appropriate staffing levels. And I think some of the hospitals, and I give credit to the folks who came up and testified, some sound like they have some really good processes in place already, but clearly based on the testimony of the proponents, some do not. And this huge gulf, this scary gulf of treatment and appropriate staffing that we have across Minnesota, just makes the argument for the bill even stronger.
Very good. Mr. Chairman, I got another question to follow
up. You would just one brief one, so we got seven on the list.
Sure.
Give everybody a chance.
Thank you. I didn't think it was necessary to bring our other testifiers that came up first, because I think, you know, the data kind of speaks for itself, doesn't it? You know, in terms of we had somebody up from the health department talking about licensure and the process, and if there were the magnitude that we heard in the first testifiers, wouldn't that those incidents of issues being caused by staffings be much, much greater than they are now?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I think that the testimony also speaks for itself. I suspect that the root cause of many of the issues, when we dig down, it probably still is staffing. If you had appropriate staffing to secure the well-being of patients, you wouldn't have those causes or those outcomes in the first place.
Very good. Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I got a question for Ms. Finn, or Pin, Mary, or Pin, Mary Pin, that was if she could come down. Because something she said just stuck in my mind. And Ms. Pin, you talked about the average wages that the salaries that these people make and the dollar amount of the annual salary they're made. And I guess it didn't compute with me. I guess I always use the figuring that in an average work year, if you work a 40-hour week, you get 2,080 hours. So a quick math on that is whatever they're making per hour, you double that, and that's what they get per year. So at $44 an hour, we're talking, that would be $88,000 a year. And you said that the average nurse makes 91 something plus a year. So does that mean they're working a lot of overtime? Because that's, you know, a bit above what they'd be making if they just made a straight, work a straight 40-hour week.
Ms. Penn?
As I had done the math, it was computed on full-time work, so that amount, $44 an hour times 2,080 hours a year, would compute to the annual amount I gave. So it does not take into account overtime, but full-time work in our hospital industry is 2,080 hours a year.
And they get...
Representative Nelson?
Ms. Penn, then they get no time off for vacation or sick leave, so they're working 52 weeks, no time off at all.
Ms. Penn? Just go through the chair.
Yeah.
To give the example of what that would be annualized, the majority of our nurses in the Twin Cities do work part-time. That amount would be prorated, but again, for comparison purposes, and full-time, you know, would be 10 days in a 14-day period would be full-time. So there's weekends, and of course they have benefits of holidays and vacation time, paid time off.
Ms. Penn, that math still doesn't add up to me. So there's got to be some overtime that they're adding into that, because 44, even at 2,080, is not it doesn't come to the figure that you quoted. But that's okay. I guess that just when I'm looking at this and I'm hearing about the staffing, I know both sides are concerned about patient safety. I know my mother is a retired LPN, and I know that's one of the reasons why she left the industry. Retired earlier than she wanted to, was that a short staffing was an issue where she worked, and it was just she'd have to work her shift and then spend hours afterward doing all the paperwork she was supposed to be doing during the day going along, but didn't ever had time for it, and it just was getting too much for her, so that's why she retired early. So I guess I understand there's short staffing, I understand things come up, but I mean this these people deserve to be able to have the safe staffing level so that they can be safe in their jobs.
Thank you. Representative Uglin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, Representative Atkins. Why isn't this being addressed through the collective bargaining process that, you know, this nation has, you know, many, many years of experience with these types of issues, and why hasn't it been addressed? Why do we need a bill and government to intrude like this?
Representative Atkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Uglin. That's a terrific question. I think for years and years, there was an effort to address it at the collective bargaining table, and for whatever reason, and you could ask folks on either side of that why it didn't occur. For me, though, in all sincerity, I don't think it's an issue for collective bargaining. Patient safety, patients' protection ought not to be decided at the bargaining table. It's so way beyond that. And from what I've heard from the testimony and the striking gulf of or disparity in what's happening in certain hospitals versus others, it just cries out for this legislation, and it shouldn't be decided at individual collective bargaining tables, some of which don't have collective bargaining, I might add. You know, some aren't union places.
Follow-up,
Mr. Chair, yes. Well, you know, this is a difficult question, and it's evidenced by all the people that are in the room here today. And you know, I applaud the nurses, but I think the nurses in the hospitals, you know, we all share the same goal, and that's good patient care, and mm-hmm. Minnesota has right now some of the best patient care in the country, if not the greatest. And I would never hold California up for any kind of standards,
nor am I, Mr.
for just about anything as far as that goes. But you know, I ran a number of companies, manufacturing companies, for many years. And I just cannot see how something like this. I think it intrudes on the management labor relationship a great deal. You need to have flexibility. Management has to manage and manage in a responsible manner. But you need that flexibility to take care of things. And taking this away and mandating this, and also the idea that there couldn't be any layoffs. and the fact that some of the LPNs and other people like that could be hurt, I just think there has to be a better answer than this. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Representative Metza?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question would be for the Minnesota Department of Health. So sorry to make you run back down.
And members, given the importance of this issue, we're going to go a time certain of 9:55, you know, to make sure everyone gets a chance to ask their questions so they don't feel under too much of a time stress. But so that'll be the plan. If you'd ask a question on the way down, she could probably catch it.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is, I'm kind of reading about these root cause analysis that have been done. And who does the analysis? Is it the hospital?
Ms. Schroeder?
Yep, Mr. Chair and Representative Metza. According to the adverse events reporting law that we have, when one of 28 serious reportable events happens in Minnesota, which includes things from bed sores and serious falls to certain surgical events and other issues, a facility is required to do a root cause analysis, and they are required to look at a number of factors that may have led to the event. We do ask who was involved in the root cause analysis, and we always hope and encourage that it is a broad group that's involved in the root cause analysis. It should never be just administrators doing it. There should be people who were involved in the event who can talk about what happened and why and what the timeline was. So I think that is generally what happens. It wouldn't be somebody from outside of the event looking at it and trying to decide what happened. It would be somebody who was involved and understands kind of the nuances of what happened.
Okay, thank you. And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Representative Mesa?
So it is not your organization that puts it into, you know, one of the different rules, policies, procedures column or communication, physical environment. It would be up to the organization to determine that, or do they send you the report and then you determine which column it ends up in as far as in that report?
Ms. Roder?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Metza. We do not categorize the findings. The facility reports to us and categorizes the event into one of those buckets and lets us know where they see the root cause lying. We review the root cause analysis and make sure that we feel it was robust enough, but we don't do the categorization for them.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Very good. Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have any questions, but just a few comments I'd like to make, and I'll be as brief as I can. I came into this hearing this morning with an open mind, which I promised some people that I spoke to over the last couple of days that I would do. And I listened very carefully to the testimony, and I have spent many hours over the last couple of weeks reviewing things that I think are linked to this particular issue. And I'd like to believe, as I do, that most Minnesotans believe in quality of care. And I want to give due credit to the author, Representative Adkins, for carrying this bill, but more importantly, in his efforts to work with interested and willing parties to put something together that makes sense. As he said early on in his comments, this is different than things that the legislature has seen in the past. And I think what's important to me as I forge my decision on this issue is the use of nationally recognized standards. And within these standards, oftentimes, is the use of empirical data. And I can speak very well to this issue, not so much in this industry, but in the industry that I come from, because we struggle with the same issues. In this case, we are talking about patient safety, and I can relate that to public safety in the job that I do. We are talking about safety of the patients. We are talking about safety of the employees. We are talking about quality of care, and we are talking about how effective a service can be. This is not a new concept by any means. In the fire service, we use nationally recognized standards to set safe staffing levels, and that is done through OSHA, it's done through NFPA, and it is done through other nationally recognized standards. It's not a new concept. It's a good concept because it takes the local politics out of it, and it brings in experts that make decisions based on empirical data. We are going to be talking about and have already started discussions this session about a significant hospital expansion here in Minnesota, in which a hospital is going to come to the legislature and ask for Minnesota to make a significant investment in an expansion project, which, quite frankly, I think is a great project. And I'm willing to support that. But hand in hand with that, we want to make sure that our quality of care continues to stay at the level that it's at, and we want to make sure that the service that we're providing is good. Two final points, very quick, Mr. Chair. I take offense to the comment from the testifier from the MHA, Mr. Massa. In his testimony, he says that the legislation before you isn't about standards of care. It's about government-mandated staffing quotas, and that is absolutely not true. I don't think that I'm misinformed. I spend many, many hours researching each one of these decisions that we make, as I think everybody around this table does. And we are not mandating quotas. We are mandating a reference to a nationally recognized standard. So with those, I'll close because I know our time is short.
Thank you, Mr. Simonson. Representative Simonson and Representative Kiefer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, we're running out of time, and I was going to see if there's any possibility that you could lay this over for more discussion in another meeting. But having said that, I would just like to say that I have looked at the bill. There's a lot of holes in it. One of my concerns is this a working group that's going to be put together, and it's not, I don't, in my opinion, find it a balanced group. There's eight nurses and then two to potentially four other people that might have a different perspective. And the councils that I work on, it's always very balanced. There's five members from business, five members from the AFL-CIO and the work comp group, for example. So that would be a question I'd have. The other thing is on line 4.1, the posting staffing levels, is there a penalty? How would that be enforced? What happens as, you know, you can't always determine how many patients you're going to have in a unit so on a certain day, because people don't plan to get sick, generally speaking, hopefully not. So I just wondered how you enforce that and if there's penalties. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You want to give us more time on this in another committee?
No, I think we have sufficient time. Let me also note, members, that it's not going to be rushed through the legislature by any stretch of imagination. That's going to, if it passes, we're going to take a vote on it, obviously. The path is government operations, health and human service policy, health and human service finance. So it has the opportunity for full vetting. So
I thought you were just going to send it to the consent calendar, Mr. Chairman. It seems like we've got everything worked out.
But we do want to make sure that people have the opportunity to ask questions in this particular committee as well. And with that, let's move to Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that was just, as I was kind of 360ing the whole matter, was collective bargaining. And Mr. Howard brought something up that I thought was kind of interesting, that they had a collective bargaining agreement at St. Mary's where they had a grid, and he was indicating that they weren't following that grid. I guess I'd just like to ask Mr. Howard if he's grieved that, or if his membership has grieved that, and the outcome of that, because he said it just kind of went away. And I know that that's something that, that labor has as a tool to be able to work on that, and so I'm curious to learn more about that.
Very good. And Mr. Howard, to Representative O'Driscoll's question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative O'Driscoll. Yes, it's something that we worked on 3 years ago. That was something we walked an informational picket line, tried to get the staffing language put into our contract, and we're renegotiating a contract 3 years later. That contract is not enforced. It's something we're, it's a work in progress. So it was started, it was, and we're here 3 years later still without that contract actually in place and enforced.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Howard, it wasn't a part of your collective bargaining agreement that was ratified by membership and management. It was an item that you had that you wanted to include. Is that, am I missing that? Because
let me see. Robert.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Howard?
Oh, I was looking for our business agent, Robert.
Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Benson.
Mr. Chairman.
Just to help.
But indeed, did the witness testifying make a false statement?
Right. We're still working on
Mr.
it.
Mr. Howard.
Oh, sorry. Mr. Chairman, sorry.
In response to Representative Driscoll's question, I guess.
Sure. Representative Driscoll, still working on it. We agreed on it. We ratified that contract, but we still don't have it as a day-to-day working. It's not something we use on a day-to-day process or day-to-day staffing issues.
Representative Driscoll?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Howard, so it is a part of the collective bargaining agreement, and you have or have not grieved it with management as a part of the process or gone to the Board of Mediation or used some other state tools that are available right now?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Driscoll, correct. We're trying to work with management to ratify that. We were trying to work with management to get these grids, get the staffing plan up and running. So we've been working with management this entire time. We've had meetings upon meetings to get that figured out and put it in working order. We still are not there.
And I think
Mr. Chair.
Did you want to hear from Ms. McCarthy? Did you want to say something briefly?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Howard happens to be a registered nurse at one of the organizations that I'm the chief nursing officer at. We have been meeting with the bargaining unit. We have sat down just within the last 3 weeks. The last time, sitting down with them, looking at their staffing ratios, their staffing patterns on every single unit in the organization. So we have worked with them to see what kind of positions are open, what kind of positions are not filled, and what would make staffing improvements on different shifts or when different security occur throughout the system. So we are very active in working with the bargaining unit. We are not negotiating our contract. It's not due till spring, but the open communication has been and numerous hours have been spent. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you very much. And Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. And I do appreciate that this is going to, we'll be going through several more committees. Unfortunately, I won't be serving any of those committees. This is my only chance to ask some really important questions to me and my community, as I do have two very small community hospitals in my district, of which I've toured both and talked to staff, nurses, administration alike at both the Buffalo Hospital and the Monticello Hospital. And this is a critical issue for my district. This is an incredibly, incredibly important issue for the little small hospitals in my district, and there is a great fear interpretation that if this rolls through that they will be out of business. The Monticello facility is just hanging on by a thread right now. They had some disputes between some associate doctors and their CEO, who's no longer there, and they are just starting to come back to life, and I have great fear that this will roll through and cause so much financial burden upon them that they will close, and I don't want my small community hospitals to close. And you know, the community I grew up in was Clearwater County, one of the poorest counties in the state, and little tiny Bagley has a little community hospital up there. And when I was 15 years old and was in a horrible car accident and had a C2 neck fracture, that little tiny hospital was my only avenue to receive help. You know, I mean, it's the only thing up there. Bemidji is further the other way, and it's vital to that community. These two hospitals are incredibly, incredibly vital to my community, and I'm being told that this is detrimental to them, and that deeply affects me. That affects my community. It affects, you know, further up north, where there are just so little facilities up there. And so I listen very, very carefully to my administration, the administration from the hospitals. I listen to the charge nurses, and the charge nurses told me this incredible story of this almost like a dance of how they have to staff. And, you know, they have their base staff, but if they have more patients come in, they call in more staff. And to mandate, now I know that you said that there's going to be this incredible board, right, that will research it and have national standards, but the end result is a mandate, right? I mean, that is where we are rolling towards. So someone at some point is going to say, this is what you have to do. And I have great concern that that is going to detrimentally affect the small community hospitals in my district and in the place where I grew up, near Bagley. Now, I have a few questions because I hear completely different things from both sides. And I am a factual-based decision maker. Numbers and facts and figures. And so I'd actually like to speak to the Department of Health once again. Well, she seems to be a popular testifier today, but...
If you want to proceed, we've got about maximum just a couple minutes left. Want to proceed with your question as she comes down?
Absolutely. When... And I'm sorry, her name again?
Roderick. Ms. Roderick.
Ms. Roderick, when you were testifying before, you had said something that just... I want to make sure I heard correctly, because you were asked about how many of these adverse events were directly related to... I'm sorry, I can't see you. Were directly related to staffing, short staffing. And I thought you had said it was a very rare occurrence that it happens maybe one time a year. Was that accurate from your testimony?
Ms. Roderick?
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, I think the question was how often we get complaints that come in related to staffing through our licensure system. And on that, I need to check, and am already working on that since that's not my area. I did also say that we collect that information through the adverse events system, or rather we require hospitals to ask a series of questions related to staffing as part of their root cause analysis. In the data that we receive through that system, we don't see staffing come up very often. It is probably only once or twice a year among the events that we collect data on.
Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Philip. And so just so that I'm very clear, you're speaking to the adverse health events and that tying that to short staffing is a rare event. Is that correct?
Ms. Roderick?
Mr. Chair and Representative O'Neill, yes, it is a rare event to come in through that system. I always want to give some cautions that this is a system that collects data on a certain set of events, not every situation that can happen in a facility. It doesn't deal with certain issues. So I think it's important to keep in mind what that system is and is not. But with that particular set of events, which includes serious falls, pressure ulcers or bed sores, et cetera, we very rarely see staffing come up as a root cause.
Okay.
Follow-up, last please. Question, Representative O'Neill.
Yes, please. And then this report that is in front of us for adverse health events, it only is a snapshot for 1 year. And so could you speak to the trends as far as, let's just pick serious injuries or falls. Do you happen to know, because what I see is from 2011 to 2012, so the 2011 number was 83. That's the hard number. 2012 was 89. It's a change of 6 incidences over how many millions of patients. I don't even know how many, thousands, I don't know, 100, I don't know how many patients come through hospitals. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could just, if you know an average number of patients per year, that's only a 6% change from 1 year to the next. Do you have a trend line from, you started doing this from 2003, mm-hmm. that we could actually have some substantive data to say what, just one incident, like the serious falls?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Roderick?
Yep, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. We do have that information. The number of serious injuries that has happened over the years does vary, partly because definitions have changed over the years. So in the early years of the system, and we've been doing this for 9 years, we collected a smaller number of events or a smaller grouping, and it didn't include some of those serious falls that lead to hip fractures and head injuries. So we had a smaller number of serious injuries in the early years of the system. Since then, harm has fluctuated a little bit. We did have an increase from 1 year to the next with this last report. In general, over the last few years, it's trended very, very slightly downward. But again, harm is one important measure that we look at, but we don't know just by looking at that what the cause was of the fall or the event. So some of those cases of harm are related to an attempted suicide or a hypoglycemia or another type of event. It may or may not have had anything to do with staffing levels or policies or procedures or any particular root cause. So you'd have to look at the reasons for it rather than just the numbers themselves.
Last comment from Representative Fisher. I think you were on the list that you wanted to say something.
Yes, thank you, Chair.
We're going to move to the vote.
Just very quickly, I want to mention that I'm seeing this as a classic between labor and staff is what needs to be determined here. And I think one of the things we have to keep in mind is there's another overriding value, and that's the vulnerable populations here, and that management and staff doesn't always agree as to where things are going down the road. Only 20% are covered by labor contracts right now, leaving 80% out there not covered. I think it's appropriate that we've done staffing ratios in many other industries, whether it's childcare, how many people you have when you're taking care of kids. I think it's very much along the same line as where we've had those kind of things. I appreciate that there's been flexibility in trying to put more on the author side and going away from hard numbers to try to address the reality and trying to get to more of a national standard. But I think it's very important. I'll leave it at that. I know I'll get to see it at another committee coming up, and I'll ask more questions then.
Very good. Representative O'Neill?
Thank you. I still, you know, I just feel like we haven't had enough time to vet this. I feel like we're just starting to get to the real true data, because we've got one side saying one thing and one side saying the other, and they look completely different. And I think that if we're going to make decisions, it should be based in fact, numbers, statistics, you know, exactly what this bill speaks to, national standards, data and information. And I feel like we have not vetted this enough. I have more questions. I feel like we've just barely gotten to some of the answers. I think we need the Department of Health to come back and speak to, almost like as an impartial person, to speak to some of the
facts.
I'm
sure she'd be willing to continue to take questions offline from you, Representative. But at this point, we are going to take the vote.
Mr. Chair, I call for roll call, please.
Roll call being requested. Representative Atkins renews his motion. I renew the motion that House File 58 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the committee. 588 be recommended to pass as amended and re-referred to the Committee on Government Operations. Roll call being requested. Clerk will take the roll.
Johnson.
Aye.
Benson.
No.
Fisher.
Aye.
Hoppe.
Nope.
Kiefer?
No.
Lane?
Aye.
Mason?
Aye.
Metza?
Aye.
Nelson?
Aye.
O'Driscoll?
No.
O'Neill?
No.
Savick?
Aye.
Simonson?
Aye.
Sundin?
Aye.
Uglem?
No.
The bill passes 9-6.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Congratulations.